This is a reading of Theosophy, an introduction to the supersensible knowledge of the world and the destination of man by Rudolf Steiner, translated by Henry P. Mungus and revised for this edition by Gilbert Church, Ph.D., copyright 1971. I'm going to skip the prefaces and go directly to the introduction. When in the autumn of 1813, Johann Gottlieb Fichte gave to the world, as the ripe fruit of a life wholly devoted to the service of truth, his introduction to the science of knowledge, he said at the very outset, quote, "This doctrine presupposes an entirely new inner sense organ or instrument through which a new world is revealed, having no existence for the ordinary man," unquote. He then showed by a simile how incomprehensible this doctrine must be when judged by conceptions of the ordinary senses. Quote, "Think of a world of people born blind, who therefore know only those objects and relations that exist through the sense of touch. Go among them and speak to them of colors and the other relations that exist only through light and for the sense of sight. You will convey nothing to their minds, and this will be the more fortunate if they tell you so, for you will then quickly notice your mistake, and if unable to open their eyes, you will cease talking in vain," unquote. Now those who speak about such things as Fichte does in this instance often find themselves in the position of a normal man among those born blind. Yet these are the things that relate to a man's true being and highest goal, and to believe it necessary, quote, "to cease talking in vain," unquote, would be to despair of humanity. We ought not to doubt for one moment the possibility of opening the eyes of every earnest person to these things. On this supposition, all those have written and spoken who have felt within themselves that the inner sense instrument had developed, thereby enabling them to know the true nature and being of man, which is generally hidden from the outer senses. Hence, from the most ancient times, such a hidden wisdom has been spoken of again and again. Those who have grasped some understanding of it feel just as sure of their possession as people with normal eyes feel sure of their ability to visualize color. For them, this hidden wisdom requires no proof. They know also that this hidden wisdom requires no proof for anyone else to whom the, quote, "higher sense," unquote, has unfolded itself. They can speak to such a person as a traveler can speak about America, to people who have themselves never seen that country, but who can visualize it, for they would see all that he has seen were the opportunity to present itself to them. It is not, however, only to researchers into the spiritual world that the observer of the supersensible has to speak. He must address his words to all men, because he has to give an account of things that concern all men. Indeed, he knows that without a knowledge of these things, no one can, in the true sense of the word, be a human being. Thus he speaks to all men because he knows there are different degrees of understanding for what he has to say. The feeling for truth and the power of understanding it are inherent in everyone, and he knows that even those who are still far from the moment in which they will acquire the ability to make their own spiritual research can bring a measure of understanding to meet him. He addresses himself first to this understanding that can flash forth in every healthy soul. He knows that in this understanding there is a force that must slowly lead to the higher degrees of knowledge. This feeling, which perhaps at first perceives nothing at all of what is told, is itself the magician that opens the, quote, "eye of the spirit," unquote. In darkness this feeling stirs. The soul sees nothing, but through this feeling it is seized by the power of truth. The truth then gradually draws nearer to the soul and opens the higher sense in it. In one person it may take a longer, in another a shorter time. Everyone, however, who has patience and endurance reaches this goal, for although not every physical eye can be operated on, every spiritual eye can be opened. When it will be opened is a question of time, only a question of time. Erudition and scientific training are not prerequisite conditions for the unfolding of this higher sense. It can develop in the unsophisticated person just as in the renowned scientist. Indeed, what is often called at the present time the only true science can, for the attainment of this goal, be frequently a hindrance rather than a help, because this science considers real only what is accessible to the ordinary senses. Its merits in regard to the knowledge of that reality may be ever so great, Yet when science declares that what is necessary and a blessing for itself shall also be authoritative for all human knowledge, it thereby creates a mass of prejudices that close the approach to higher realities. The objection is often made to what has been said that insurmountable limits have been once and forever set to man's knowledge, and since a man cannot overstep these limits, all knowledge must be rejected that does not take them into account. Furthermore, the one who presumes to make assertions about things, which for many stand proved as lying beyond the limits of man's capacity for knowledge, is looked upon as being highly immodest. In making such objections, the fact is entirely disregarded that a development of the human powers of knowledge must precede the higher knowledge. What lies beyond the limits of knowledge before such a development takes place is, after the awakening of faculties slumbering in every man, entirely within the realm of knowledge. One point in this connection must not be neglected. It might be said, quote, "Of what use is it to speak to people about things for which their powers of knowledge are not yet awakened, and are therefore still closed to them?" Unquote. This is really the wrong way to view the matter. Certain powers are required to discover the things referred to, but if, after having been discovered, they are made known, every person can understand them who is willing to bring to them unprejudiced logic and a healthy sense of truth. In this book, the things made known are wholly of a kind that must produce the impression that through them the riddles of human life and the phenomena of the world can be satisfactorily approached. This impression will be produced upon everyone who permits thought, unclouded by prejudice, and a feeling for truth free and without reservation to work within them. Put yourself for a moment in the position of asking, quote, "If the things asserted here are true, do they afford a satisfying explanation of life?" Unquote. You will find that the life of every man supplies a confirmation. In order to be a teacher in these higher regions of existence, it is by no means sufficient to have simply developed the sense for them. To that end, science is just as necessary as it is for the teacher's calling in the world of ordinary reality. Higher seeing alone does not make a knower in the spiritual, any more than healthy sense organs make a scholar in the realm of sensible realities. Because in truth all reality, the lower as well as the higher, spiritual, are only two sides of one and the same fundamental being, anyone who is ignorant in the lower branches of knowledge will, as a rule, remain ignorant in the higher. This fact creates a feeling of immeasurable responsibility in the person who, through a spiritual call, feels himself summoned to speak about the spiritual regions of existence. It imposes upon him humility and reserve. This should deter no one, not even those whose other circumstances of life afford them no opportunity for the study of ordinary science, from occupying himself with the higher truths. Everyone can fulfill his task as a man without understanding anything of botany, zoology, mathematics, and the other sciences. He cannot, however, in the full sense of the word, be a human being without having come in some way or other nearer to an understanding of the nature and destination of man as revealed to the knowledge of the supersensible. The highest to which a man is able to look he calls the divine, and he somehow must think of the highest destiny as being in connection with this divinity. The wisdom, therefore, that reaches out beyond the sensible and reveals to him his own being and with it his final goal may well be called divine wisdom or theosophy. To the study of the spiritual processes in human life and in the cosmos, the term spiritual science may be given. When, as in this book, one extracts from this spiritual science those special results that have reference to the spiritual core of man's being, then the expression theosophy may be employed or designate this domain because it has been employed for centuries in this way. From this point of view, there will be sketched in this book an outline of the theosophical conception of the universe. The writer of it will bring forward nothing that is not a fact for him, in the same sense that an experience of the outer world is a fact for eyes and ears and the ordinary intelligence. The concern here is with experiences that become accessible to everyone who is determined to tread the path of knowledge described in a later chapter of this book. We take the right attitude towards the things of the supersensible world when we assume that sound thinking and feeling are capable of understanding everything of true knowledge that emerges from the higher worlds. Further, when we start from this foundation and therewith lay down a firm foundation, we have also made a great step forward towards seeing for ourselves, even though in order to attain this other things must be added also. We lock and bolt the door to the true higher knowledge, however, when we despise this road and are determined to penetrate the higher worlds only in some other way. To have decided to recognize higher worlds only when we have seen them is a hindrance in the way of this very seeing itself. The determination to understand first through sound thinking what later can be seen furthers that seeing. It conjures forth important powers of the soul that lead to the seeing of the seer. And now, Theosophy, an introduction to the supersensible knowledge of the world and the destination of man by Rudolf Steiner. Chapter 1. The Essential Nature of Man. The following words of Goethe point beautifully to the beginning of one way by which the essential nature of man can be known. Quote, "As soon as a person becomes aware of the objects around him, he considers them in relation to himself, and rightly so, because his whole fate depends on whether they please or displease him, attract or repel, help or harm him. This quite natural way of looking at or judging things appears to be as easy as it is necessary. A person is, nevertheless, exposed through it to a thousand errors that often make him ashamed and embitter his life. A far more difficult task is undertaken by those whose keen desire for knowledge urges them to strive to observe the objects of nature as such, and in their relationship to each other. These individuals soon feel the lack of the test that helped them when they as men regarded the objects in reference to themselves personally. They lack the test of pleasure and displeasure, attraction and repulsion, usefulness and harmfulness. Yet this test must be renounced entirely. They ought, as dispassionate and, so to speak, divine beings, to seek and examine what is, not what gratifies. Thus the true botanist should not be moved either by the beauty or by the usefulness of the plants. He must study their formation and their relation to the rest of the plant kingdom. They are one, and all enticed forth and shone upon by the sun without distinction. And so he should, equably and quietly, look at and survey them all, and obtain the test for this knowledge, the data for his deductions, not out of himself, but from within the circle of the things he observes." Unquote. This thought, thus expressed by Goethe, directs man's attention to three divisions of things. First, the objects concerning which information continually flows to him through the doors of his senses, the objects he touches, smells, tastes, hears, and sees. Second, the impressions that these make on him, characterizing themselves through the fact that he finds the one sympathetic, the other abhorrent, the one useful, another harmful. Third, the knowledge that he, as a, quote, so to speak, divine being, unquote, acquires concerning the objects, that is, the secrets of their activities and their being as they unveil themselves to him. These three divisions are distinctly separate in human life, and man thereby becomes aware that he is interwoven with the world in a threefold way. The first division is one that he finds present, that he accepts as a given fact. Through the second, he makes the world into his own affair, into something that has a meaning for him. The third he regards as a goal towards which he ought unceasingly to strive. Why does the world appear to man in this threefold way? A simple consideration will explain it. I cross a meadow covered with flowers. The flowers make their colors known to me through my eyes. That is the fact I accept as given. Having accepted the fact, I rejoice in the splendor of the colors. Through this I turn the fact into an affair of my own. Through my feelings, I connect the flowers with my own existence. Then, a year later, I go again over the same meadow. Other flowers are there. Through them, new joy arises in me. My joy of the former year will appear as a memory. This is in me. The object that aroused it in me is gone, but the flowers I now see are of the same kind as those I saw the year before. They have grown in accordance with the same laws as have the others. If I have informed myself regarding this species and these laws, I then find them again in the flowers of this year, just as I found them in those of last year. So I shall perhaps muse, quote, "The flowers of last year are gone, and my joy in them remains only in my memory. It is bound up with my existence alone. What I recognized in the flowers of last year and recognize again this year, however, will remain as long as such flowers grow. That is something that revealed itself to me, but it is not dependent on my existence in the same way as my joy is. My feelings of joy remain in me. The laws, the being of the flowers, remain outside of me in the world." Unquote. By these means, man continually links himself in this threefold way with the things of the world. One should not for the present read anything into this fact, but merely take it as it stands. From this it can be seen that man has three sides to his nature. This and nothing else will for the present be indicated here by the three words body, soul, and spirit. Whoever connects any preconceived opinions or even hypotheses with these three words will necessarily misunderstand the following explanations. By body is here meant that through which the things in the environment of a man reveal themselves to him, as in the above example, the flowers in the meadow. By the word soul is signified that by which he links the things to his own being, through which he experiences pleasure and displeasure, desire and aversion, joy and sorrow in connection with them. By spirit is meant what becomes manifest in him when, as Goethe expressed it, he looks at things as a, quote, so to speak, divine being, unquote. In this sense, man consists of body, soul, and spirit. Through his body, man is able to place himself, for the time being, in connection with things. Through his soul, he retains in himself the impressions they make on him. Through his spirit, there reveals itself to him what the things retain for themselves. Only when we observe man in these three aspects can we hope to throw light on his whole being, because they show him to be related in a threefold way to the rest of the world. Through his body, man is related to the objects that present themselves to his senses from without. The materials from the outer world compose his body, and the forces of the outer world work also in it. He observes the things of the outer world with his senses, and he also is able to observe his own bodily existence. It is impossible, however, for him to observe his soul existence in the same way. Everything in him that is bodily process can be perceived with his bodily senses. His likes and dislikes, his joy and pain, neither he nor anyone else can perceive with bodily senses. The region of the soul is inaccessible to bodily perception. The bodily existence of a man is manifest to all eyes. The soul existence he carries within himself as his world. Through the spirit, however, the outer world is revealed to him in a higher way. The mysteries of the outer world indeed unveil themselves in his inner being. He steps in spirit out of himself and lets the things speak about themselves, about what has significance, not for him, but for them. For example, man looks up at the starry heavens. The delight his soul experiences belongs to him. The eternal laws of the stars that he comprehends in thought, in spirit, belong not to him, but to the stars themselves. In this way, man is a citizen of three worlds. Through his body, he belongs to the world that he also perceives through his body. Through his soul, he constructs for himself his own world. Through his spirit, a world reveals itself to him that is exalted above both the others. It seems obvious that because of the essential differences of these three worlds, a clear understanding of them and of man's share in them can only be obtained by means of three different modes of observation. Subsection number 1, the corporeal nature of man. We learn to know man's body through bodily senses, and the manner of observing it cannot differ from the way in which we learn to know other objects perceived by the senses. As we observe minerals, plants, and animals, so can we also observe man. He is related to these three forms of existence. Like the minerals, he builds his body out of natural substances. Like the plants, he grows and propagates his species. Like the animals, he perceives the objects around him and builds up his inner experiences on the basis of the impressions they make on him. Thus a mineral, a plant, and an animal existence may be ascribed to man. The differences in structure of minerals, plants, and animals correspond with the three forms of their existence. It is this structure, the shape, that is perceived through the senses, and that alone can be called body. Now the human body is different from that of the animal. This difference must be recognized, whatever may otherwise be thought of the relationship of man to animals. Even the most extreme materialist, who denies all soul, cannot but admit the truth of this passage uttered by Carus in his Organon der Natur und des Geistes, quote, "The finer inner construction of the nervous system, and especially of the brain, remains still an unsolved problem for the physiologist and the anatomist. That this concentration of structures ever increases in the animal kingdom and reaches in man a stage unequaled in any other being is a fully established fact. A fact that is of the deepest significance in regard to the mental evolution of man. Indeed, we may go so far as to say it is really a sufficient explanation of that evolution. Where, therefore, the structure of the brain has not developed properly, where its smallness and poverty are in evidence, as in the case of microcephali and idiots, it goes without saying that we can no more expect the appearance of original ideas and of knowledge than we can expect the propagation of the species from persons with completely stunted reproductive organs. On the other hand, a strong and beautifully developed build of the whole man, and especially of the brain, will certainly not in itself take the place of genius, but it will at any rate supply the first and indispensable condition for higher knowledge." Unquote. Just as one ascribes to the human body the three forms of existence, mineral, plant, and animal, so one must ascribe to it a fourth, the distinctively human form. Through his mineral existence, man is related to everything visible. Through his plant-like existence, to all beings that grow and propagate their species. Through his animal existence, to all those that perceive their surroundings, and by means of external impressions, have inner experiences. Through his human form of existence, he constitutes, even in regard to his body alone, a kingdom by himself. Subsection 2. The soul nature of man. Man's soul nature, as his own inner world, is different from his bodily nature. When attention is turned to even the simplest sensation, what is personally his own comes at once to the fore. Thus no one can know whether one person perceives even a simple sensation in exactly the same way as another. It is known that there are people who are colorblind. They see things only in various shades of gray. Others are only partially colorblind. Because of this, they are unable to distinguish between certain shades of color. The picture of the world that their eyes gives them is different from that of so-called normal persons. The same holds good more or less in regard to the other senses. Thus it will be seen without further elaboration that even simple sensations belong to the inner world. I can perceive with my bodily senses the red table that another person perceives, but I cannot perceive his sensation of red. We must therefore describe sensation as belonging to the soul. If this single fact is grasped quite clearly, we shall soon cease to regard inner experiences as mere brain processes or something similar. Feeling must link itself with sensation. One sensation causes us pleasure, another displeasure. These are stirrings of our inner life, our soul life. In our feelings we create a second world, in addition to the one following on us from without. A third is added to this, the world of the will. Through the will, we react on the outer world, thereby stamping the impress of our inner being upon it. The soul of man, as it were, flows outwards in the activities of his will. The actions of man differ from the occurrences of outer nature in that they bear the impress of his inner life. Thus the soul, as man's own possession, stands confronting the outer world. He receives from the outer world the incitements, but he creates in response to these incitements a world of his own. The body becomes the foundation of the soul being of man. Subsection 3. The spiritual nature of man. The soul nature of man is not determined by the body alone. Man does not wander aimlessly and without purpose from one sensation to another, nor does he act under the influence of every casual incitement that plays upon him, either from without or through the processes of his body. He thinks about his perceptions and his acts. By thinking about his perceptions, he gains knowledge of things. By thinking about his acts, he introduces a reasonable coherence into his life. He knows that he will worthily fulfill his duty as a man only when he lets himself be guided by correct thoughts in knowing as well as in acting. The soul of man, therefore, is confronted by a twofold necessity. By the laws of the body, it is governed by natural necessity. It allows itself also to be governed by the laws that guide it to exact thinking, because it voluntarily acknowledges their necessity. Nature subjects man to the laws of changing matter, but he subjects himself to the laws of thought. By this means, he makes himself a member of a higher order than the one to which he belongs through his body. This order is the spiritual. The spiritual is as different from the soul as the soul is from the body. As long as only the particles of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and oxygen that are in motion in the body are spoken of, we do not have the soul in view. Soul life begins only when, within the motion of these particles, the feeling arises, quote, I taste sweetness, unquote, or, quote, I feel pleasure, unquote. Likewise, we do not have the spirit in view as long as merely those soul experiences are considered that course through anyone who gives himself over entirely to the outer world and his bodily life. This soul life is rather the basis of the spiritual, just as the body is the basis of the soul life. The biologist is concerned with the body, the investigator of the soul, the psychologist with the soul, and the investigator of the spirit with the spirit. It is incumbent on those who would understand the nature of man by means of thinking, first to make clear to themselves through self-reflection the difference between body, soul, and spirit. Number 4. Body, soul, and spirit, subsection. There is a C addendum 3, which we won't get to till the end of this. Okay. Man can only come to a true understanding of himself when he grasps clearly the significance of thinking within his being. The brain is the bodily instrument of thinking. A properly constructed eye serves us for seeing colors, and a suitably constructed brain serves us for thinking. The whole body of man is so formed that it receives its crown in the physical organ of the spirit, the brain. The construction of the human brain can only be understood by considering it in relation to its task, that of being the bodily basis for the thinking spirit. This is borne out by a comparative survey of the animal world. Among the amphibians, the brain is small in comparison with the spinal cord. In mammals, it is proportionately larger. In man, it is largest in comparison with the rest of the body. There are many prejudices prevalent regarding such statements about thinking as are presented here. Many people are inclined to undervalue thinking and to place higher value on the warm life of feeling or emotion. Some even say it is not by sober thinking, but by warmth of feeling and the immediate power of the emotions that we raise ourselves to higher knowledge. People who talk in this way are afraid they will blunt the feelings by clear thinking. This certainly does result from ordinary thinking that refers only to matters of utility. In the case of thoughts that lead to higher regions of existence, what happens is just the opposite. There is no feeling and no enthusiasm to be compared with the sentiments of warmth, beauty, and exaltation that are enkindled through the pure, crystal-clear thoughts that refer to the higher worlds. The highest feelings are, as a matter of fact, not those that come of themselves, but those that are achieved by energetic and persevering thinking. The human body is so constructed that it is adapted to thinking. The same materials and forces that are present in the mineral kingdom are so combined in the human body that thought can manifest itself by means of this combination. This mineral structure, built up in accordance with its function, will be called in the following pages the physical body of man. Organized with reference to the brain as its central point, this mineral structure comes into existence by propagation and reaches its fully developed form through growth. Man shares propagation and growth in common with the plants and animals. Through propagation and growth, what is living differentiates itself from the lifeless mineral. Life gives rise to life by means of the germ. Descendant follows forefather from one living generation to another. The forces through which a mineral originates are directed upon the substances of which it is composed. A quartz crystal is formed through the forces inherent in the silicon and oxygen that are combined in the crystal. The forces that shape an oak tree must be sought for indirectly in the germ cells of the mother and father plants. The form of the oak is preserved through propagation from forefather to descendant. Thus there are inner determining conditions innate in living things, and it was a crude view of nature that held lower animals, even fishes, to have evolved out of mud. The form of the living passes itself on by means of heredity. How a living being develops depends on what father and mother it is sprung from, in other words, on the species to which it belongs. The materials it is composed of are continually changing, but the species remains constant during life and is transmitted to the descendants. Therefore, it is the species that determines the combination of the minerals. This force that determines species will here be called life force. Mineral forces express themselves in crystals, and the formative life force expresses itself in the species or forms of plant and animal life. The mineral forces are perceived by man by means of his bodily senses, and he can only perceive things for which he has such senses. Without the eye, there is no perception of light. Without the ear, no perception of sound. The lowest organisms have only one of the senses belonging to man, a kind of sense of touch. See Addendum 2. These organisms have no awareness of the world perceptible to man, with the exception of those mineral forces that they perceive by the sense of touch. In proportion to the development of the other senses in the higher animals, does their surrounding world, which man also perceives, become richer and more varied. It depends, therefore, on the organs of a being whether what exists in the outer world exists also for the being itself as something perceptible. What is present in the air has a certain motion What is present in the air as a certain motion becomes in man a sensation of hearing. Man, however, does not perceive the manifestations of the life force through the ordinary senses. He sees the colors of the plants. He smells their perfume. The life force, however, remains hidden from this form of observation. Even so, those with ordinary senses have just as little right to deny that there is a life force as the man born blind has to deny that colors exist. Colors are there for the person born blind as soon as he has undergone an operation. In the same way, the various species of plants and animals created by the life force, not merely the individual plants and animals, are present for man as objects of perception as soon as the necessary organ unfolds within him. An entirely new world opens out to him through the unfolding of this organ. He now perceives not merely the colors, the odors, and other characteristics of living beings, but the life itself of these beings. In each plant and animal he perceives, besides the physical form, the life-filled spirit form. In order to have a name for this spirit form, let it be called the ether body or life body. Footnote, a long footnote. The author wishes to note that long after this book was written, he gave the name formative force body to what is here called etheric or life body. Parenthesis, also CP Das Reich, fourth book of the first year's issue, January 1917, parenthesis. He felt himself moved to give it this name because he believes that one cannot do enough to prevent the misunderstanding due to confusing what is here called etheric body with the vital force of older natural science. In what concerns the rejection of this older concept of a vital force in the sense of modern natural science, the author shares, in a certain sense, the standpoint of those who are opposed to assuming the existence of such a vital force. The purpose of assuming such a vital force was to explain how the inorganic forces work in a special way in the organism. But there is no difference between the activity of the inorganic in the organism and its activity outside in the inorganic world. The laws of inorganic nature are in the organism no different from what they are in the crystal. But in the organism there is present something that is not inorganic, the formative life. The etheric body or formative force body lies at the base of this formative life. By assuming its existence, the rightful task of natural science is not interfered with, namely to observe the workings of forces in inorganic nature and to follow these workings into the organic world, and further, to refuse to think of these operations within the organism as being modified by a special vital force. To a true spiritual science this seems justified. The spiritual researcher speaks of the etheric body insofar as there manifests in the organism something different from what shows itself in the lifeless. In spite of all this, the author does not feel himself impelled to replace the term etheric body by the other formative force body. since within the whole connected range of what is said here, any misunderstanding is excluded for anyone who really wants to comprehend. Such a misunderstanding can only arise when the term is used in a development that cannot exhibit this connection. Parenthesis, compare this also with what is said under Addendum 1, parenthesis, end of footnote. To the investigator of spiritual life, this ether body is for him not merely a product of the materials and forces of the physical body, but a real independent entity that first calls forth into life those physical materials and forces. We speak in accordance with spiritual science when we say that a purely physical body derives its form, a crystal for example, through the action of the physical formative forces innate in the lifeless. A living body does not receive its form through the action of these forces, because in the moment life is departed from it and it is given over to the physical forces only, it falls to pieces. The ether body is an organism that preserves the physical body from dissolution every moment during life. In order to see this body, to perceive it in another being, the awakened spiritual eye is required. Without this ability, its existence as a fact can still be accepted on logical grounds, but it can be seen with the spiritual eye just as color can be seen with the physical eye. We should not take offense at the expression ether body. Ether here designates something different from the hypothetical ether of the physicist. We should regard it simply as a name for what is described here. The structure of the physical body of the human being is a kind of reflection of its purpose, and this is also the case with the human etheric body. It can be understood only when it is considered in relation to the thinking spirit. The human etheric body differs from that of plants and animals through being organized to serve the purposes of the thinking spirit. Man belongs to the mineral world through his physical body, and he belongs through this etheric body to the life world. After death, the physical body dissolves into the mineral world, the ether body into the life world. By the word body is meant whatever gives a being shape or form. The term body must not be confused with a bodily form perceptible to the physical senses. Used in the sense implied in this book, the term body can also be applied to such forms as soul and spirit may assume. The life body is still something external to man. With the first stirrings of sensation, the inner self responds to the stimuli of the outer world. You may search forever in what is called the outer world, but you will be unable to find sensation in it. Rays of light stream into the eye, penetrating it until they reach the retina. There they cause chemical processes in the so-called visual purple. The effect of these stimuli is passed on through the optic nerve to the brain. There further physical processes arise. Could these be observed, we would simply see more physical processes just as everywhere, just as elsewhere in the physical world. If I am able also to observe the ether body, I shall see how the physical brain process is at the same time a life process. The sensation of blue color that the recipient of the rays of light experiences, however, I can find nowhere in this manner. It arises only within the soul of the recipient. If, therefore, the being of this recipient consisted only of the physical and etheric bodies, in ether bodies, sensation could not exist. The activity by which sensation becomes a fact differs essentially from the operations of the formative life force. By that activity, an inner experience is called forth from these operations. Without this activity, there would be a mere life process, such as we observe in plants. Imagine a man receiving impressions from all sides. Think of him as the source of the activity mentioned above, flowing out in all directions from which he is receiving these impressions. In all directions, sensations arise in response to the stimuli. This foundation of activity is to be called the sentient soul. This sentient soul is just as real as the physical body. If a man stands before me and I disregard his sentient soul by thinking of him merely as a physical body, it is exactly as if instead of a painting I were to call up in memory merely the canvas. A statement similar to the one previously made in reference to the ether body must be made here about perceiving the sentient soul. The bodily organs are blind to it. The organ by which life can be perceived as life is also blind to it. The ether body is seen by means of this organ, and so through a still higher organ, the inner world of sensation can become a special kind of supersensible perception. Then a man not only senses the impressions of the physical and life world, but he beholds the sensations themselves. The sensation world of another being is spread out before a man with such an organ like an external reality. One must distinguish between experiencing one's own sensation world and looking at the sensation world of another person. Every man, of course, can see into his own sensation world. Only the seer with the opened spiritual eye can see the sensation world of another. Unless a man is a seer, he knows the world of sensation only as an inner one, only as the peculiar hidden experiences of his own soul. With the opened spiritual eye, there shines out before the outward-turned spiritual gaze what otherwise lives only in the inner nature of another being. I am on page 19, at the three asterisks at the top, and I will continue on the other side of this tape on page 19.
An example, the theoretical yield of carbon dioxide is 2.71 grams. In practice, the actual yield of a product may be much less than this for several possible reasons. First,